You're tuned into the Coach Onandi Show on WAMU 88.5. Welcome. Last year, the pandemic was just beginning to upend our lives. This included local museums, which closed their doors to tourists and residents. That included the massive Smithsonian system and its string of major museums on the mall. For smaller private museums, shutting down was a big blow, and it wasn't clear whether all would survive the shutdown. 1 year into the pandemic, and many museums have adapted. Many exhibits are now online, and curators host virtual programs to share their expertise in innovative ways. In this second installment of our March Kojo Connect series on how the pandemic has affected the arts and culture in our region, we're talking to curators about how museums have been faring during the pandemic and how they've made their content accessible for audiences at home. You can join the conversation by calling 800-433-8850. Have you virtually visited a museum or gallery? What was the experience like? We'd like to know. 800-433-8850. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Email to kojo@wamu.org or go to our website, kojoshow.org, and join the conversation there. Joining us now is Rebecca Roberts, curator of programming at Planet Word. Rebecca, great to talk to you again.
So happy to be here.
Also with us is Melanie Adams, director of the Smithsonian Anacostia Community Museum. Melanie Adams, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Beth Zybarth, director of the Smithsonian's Office of Accessibility. Beth Zybarth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I am happy to be here.
Beth, I'll start with you. Tell us a little bit more about your role at the Smithsonian and why it's been such a critical role over this past year, the Office of Accessibility.
Yes, my office, Access Smithsonian, works with all the museums and the zoo on providing accessibility for visitors with disabilities. And so as we closed our museums and started to plan for the eventual reopening, we needed to develop a playbook, a consolidated resource and materials that was created by a diverse team to support the museums as they reopened to the public. And in that playbook, we really needed to think about how our different policies and procedures would impact visitors with disabilities. So accessibility is in the details, and we needed to think about everything from the time ticketing process and website accessibility, the face covering policy, signage that we were communicating our different policies and procedures to visitors and how that information would be conveyed to people who couldn't read the signs, accessible equipment like loaner wheelchairs, seating in the museums, whether we were going to allow people to use benches or seating in the museums, things like staffing levels. And then we moved to online programs. And so many of the museums are now, happily providing online programs. And when we reopen, we will have probably a combination, a hybrid of in-person visits and online.
The Smithsonian system is the largest museum system, not only in the country, but in the world. What were some highlights on the program when the museums first closed a year ago?
Yeah, I'll share some examples from my office. We have one program called See Me at the Smithsonian, which is a program with individuals with dementia and their care partners, where we discuss and engage with Smithsonian collections. And programs are currently held online the first and third Wednesday of the month. We also hold programming with larger groups in community locations like Mary's House for older adults, LGBTQ-friendly residence that provides safe and affordable communal environments to adults over 60. And this spring, we're going to begin offering Spanish language programming once a month. So we know that during the pandemic, isolation and loneliness are significant issues for older adults and individuals with dementia. And online programming can help eliminate some of those potential barriers that people have for participation, such as transportation to a museum, parking, navigating an unfamiliar building, physical effort to reach a program site. So it's been quite successful.
What have you been hearing from museum aficionados about your virtual content? And are there any silver linings from this past year?
Yeah, I think, I have some quotes from some of the people who have dementia who have participated in our programs. And one person said, in this time of isolation where we can't be with people in person, it's just lovely to be with people through the screen. Still nice that we get to share things. And I really love this one. Humanity reunited and revived.
Humanity reunited and revived. We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Have you virtually visited a museum or gallery? Tell us what the experience is like. Our region is full of museums. What's your favorite? When was the last time you visited? And have you visited it virtually? 800-433-8850. Melanie Adams, tell us about the Anacostia Museum and its role. It's a Smithsonian museum, but one with an interesting history and a slightly different mission.
It is. Thank you very much. The Anacostia Community Museum, we were actually founded in 1967. So as you've mentioned, we've always been a Smithsonian museum, but we were really found during the racial unrest that was taking place in the country at that time. And the secretary at the time, Dylan Ripley, really recognized it was important to provide a space and opportunity for African-American stories. And so what he did, he worked with the community to look for a space east of the river. So our first location was down on Nichols Avenue, which is now MLK, in a former movie theater. And we've since moved little up the hill up Morris Road there into another space. But over these last almost 54 years, the Anacostia Community Museum has been in place to serve the needs of the community. And while the pandemic has been horrible for so many reasons, as well as a lot of the social justice issues that have come about during this year, I feel like ACM has really been positioned to thrive during this time. So similar to what Beth said, we've obviously done some online virtual programs. We had two great series. The first one was called Take Time Thursdays, because one of the things we recognized was this was new for all of us. So we started these programs. I guess we closed with everyone else somewhere around March 11th or 12th in about April. And these were very casual types of programs. So it's everything from cooking to arts and culture to finance, just things you may need to know during this pandemic. The other program we did during this time was something called Inspire Action, and that was really developed after the George Floyd killing in Minneapolis. And how could we have people examine specific issues and really inspire them to act? But one of the things I'm really excited about that we did was while we understood that people couldn't come to us, we found a way to go to the people. And we did this through an exhibit. We originally were scheduled to have an exhibit called Men of Change, Power, Triumph, and Truth, which was developed by our Smithsonian Institute Traveling Exhibit Services. So they developed this wonderful exhibit with support from the Ford Motor Company funding Community Services, and it was supposed to be located in our building. Well, we knew that was not going to happen, so we worked with sites to reimagine this exhibit, and now it is placed in the Deanwood community. And it is a wonderful partnership. We worked with the Ron Brown School for Boys, the Deanwood Recreation Center, as well as the Deanwood Library. And the exhibit is spread out among a two-block radius among those different sites. And it's the majority of the exhibit is there, so it's a little different than the indoor exhibit, but you still really get the flavor and the important nature of this Men of Change exhibit.
If you have calls, stay on the line. We will get to your calls. If you'd like to call, the number is 800-433-8850, or you can send us a tweet at Kojo Show. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org. Join the conversations there. Have you virtually visited a museum or gallery? Tell us what that experience was like. Rebecca Roberts' Planet Word is a new museum. For our listeners who have not heard of it, what is Planet Word, and where did the idea come from?
Right. What is a word museum? It's a question we get a lot. So Planet Word is a brand new museum of words and language. We are in the historic Franklin School at the corner of 13th and K. And when you explore words and language in a museum setting, you have to be really creative. We are not a traditional, you know, artifacts behind glass, text on a wall kind of an experience. So everything is immersive, it's voice activated, it is user directed. And so you learn how words enter the English language, you learn how languages vary around the globe, you learn how babies acquire language, and then you get to play with words and language in so many different contexts. So we have a karaoke room, we have a joke-telling gallery, we have a speech-making gallery, we have a magical library, which is really sort of jaw-dropping. And so by the end of this experience, you come away thinking about the beauty of words, the unbelievable adaptation and evolution of the English language, but also the power and importance of words. Yes, it's fun. Yes, it is a little jaw-dropping, but it is also words matter. And because English evolves for all of us, and there is no such thing as standard English, we all have that power to make it change. And so we should take that power seriously and think through how we each use our words. So we opened for 5 weekends in October, starting October 22nd. And it was great. It was just great to be open for a little while, see how people interacted with these exhibits that we had planned for so long, watch people's awe and joy and wonder at these experiences that we had just, you know, been hoping to see real humans use. And then on November 23rd, we decided with the spike in cases locally and with our fellow colleagues at other cultural institutions making the decision to close again, that we would join in supporting the safety of the community by doing that as well.
A lot of people would say that opening a new museum in D.C. is brave, period, but Planet Word opened, as you just pointed out, in October of 2020 in the midst of a pandemic, and now you're doing most of your programming virtually like the other museums. We're going to have to take a short break, but if you have called, stay on the line. We will get to your calls. If you have a question or comment, the number is 800-433-8850. A listener tweeted, "I was able to offer a virtual tour of the National Museum of Mexican Art based in Chicago to our San Antonio residents. And the shift to virtual allowed my work to be featured in a San Francisco-based museum, an opportunity I attribute to our receptiveness to geographic dispersion." 800-433-8850 is the number to call. I'm Kojo Namdi.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. We're talking about how museums in this region have been faring during the pandemic and how they have changed how they present their exhibits. We're talking with Beth Zybert, the director of the Smithsonian's Office of Accessibility, Rebecca Roberts is curator of programming at Planet Word, and Melanie Adams is director of the Smithsonian Anacostia Community Museum. And Melanie, I think our caller Nana C. in Washington, D.C. may have a challenge for you. Nana C., you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Kojo Namdi?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. You know me by another name, but I'm going to make this short. I live in what is now called Deanwood, and I didn't know about this exhibition. I don't drive. I'm 70-something. And I don't have children like you do, so I don't have anybody to take me there. How do I get there? How do I get? I'm in the Deanwood neighborhood. How do I get to this wonderful exhibition? Oh my God, Men of Change! I didn't get the rest of it. Power something.
Melanie Adams.
No. So thank you for asking. One of the things that we considered when we put this exhibit in the Deanwood community is it is right across from the Deanwood Metro Station. And so people who have visited, you can take the Deanwood Metro, Metro, and it stops right there, and it's just right across the street there at the rec center. So that is one of the things we took into account in the placement of the exhibit.
And Nanasi, nice to hear from you. Good luck visiting the exhibit in Deanwood. Here now is Mary in Annandale. Mary, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on the air. So we virtually visited the Mütter Museum up in Philadelphia and went also when COVID kind of lulled a little bit over the summer and had a really great experience, felt really safe. And their online exhibit had included so much of what they had in the museum. It made it really accessible. They did 3D modeling so you could see all the way around it just like you would be able to in the museum. And we just really had a nice time, and we've been super excited about all of the different things that the Smithsonian has had. I've participated in a few of the chats, including the Professors and Pints that has gone virtual now. And it's just been awesome. And I'm so glad that the Office of Accessibility, which does great things for folks like me with disabilities to be able to get into the museums, is doing so much more. So thank you guys so much for
that.
Well,
for people who are not familiar with the Mütter Museum, tell us what we can see there.
So the museum is filled with basically medical oddities. They have things like Einstein's brain, the largest megacolon ever removed from a person, and just all kinds of crazy medical oddities, as well as talking about the way that the 1918 pandemic hit Philadelphia.
Okay, thank you very much for sharing that with us. Speaking of medical objects, Beth Zebarth, the Smithsonian is collecting items from the pandemic, like the first vial of the COVID-19 vaccine. What is the importance of documenting the pandemic while it's happening?
There's so many implications in the scientific and medical events, as well as the effects and responses and areas of business, work, politics, culture, in terms of the pandemic effects. So our National Museum of American History and probably some of our other museums are collecting to be able to, reflect on the pandemic in the future.
Rebecca Roberts, the Planet Word isn't obviously your typical museum, and there's a particular exhibit that's really interesting. Tell us about the structural speaking willow tree. What is that?
Well, you can actually see the speaking willow from the street. So the historic Franklin School, the entrance is on 13th Street, but that has stairs, and 13th Street is a hill, and that's not accessible. So we actually moved the entrance to the museum around the corner on K Street, which is at grade, and then to make sure people knew there was something special there, because we had now just hidden the entrance to our museum. Our founder, Ann Friedman, commissioned this extraordinary work of art from artist Raphael Lozano Hemmer, and it's called The Speaking Willow, and it is this sculptural tree. But at the end of every branch, there's a speaker, a little translucent cup that is motion activated. And as you walk under the tree, these different speakers activate, and they each speak a different language. So this tree speaks 360 languages. And because a lot of the speakers are close together, you often activate more than one. So as you move under this tree, you hear this extraordinary babble of global language all around you. And you can try to sort of stand still and identify the one directly over you, or you can move around and hear, the entire globe as you go. We sometimes see kids racing around in circles under the tree to try to activate all of the speakers in a circle at once. But it also tells you from the very beginning, before you've even walked into the museum, that this is going to be a different kind of experience, that this is a museum that's going to talk to you. It's going to expect you to talk back. Your physical body is going to be part of how you experience this entire museum.
Planet Word is located at the Franklin School Building on 13th and K Street. Many Washingtonians know it. We love it as a historic and beautiful building. But there have been years, no decades, of debate about what the city should do with it. Can you talk a little bit about the building and how Planet Word got interested in it?
The building dates to 1869. It's an Adolf Kluss building. So like the Arts and Industries Building at the Smithsonian or Eastern Market or the Sumner School. It is a red brick building with towers and weather vanes, and it's quite dramatic. And it was a co-ed public high school originally. In fact, the first co-ed public high school in Washington, all white, of course, in 1869. And that's why it has two front doors, and it is, in fact, perfectly symmetrical, because although it was co-ed, having the boys and girls in class together was a bridge too far in the late 19th century. So the fact that every room on the north side is exactly mirrored on the south side actually makes it a very nice space for a museum. And it was a school for a while. It was then a teacher training school, a normal school for a while. It, for the bulk of the 20th century, was DCPS administrative offices. And then for a time, it was a homeless shelter. And then it was abandoned. So it is an unbelievably gorgeous building. It is historically protected, both exterior and interior. Inside, it has amazing original tile floors, beautiful banisters going up and down the stairs, windows looking out on Franklin Square that are just kind of breathtaking. So it's a gorgeous building that needed some love, needed some help. And so before any exhibits were installed, the entire building was rehabbed and brought back to its former glory. And places where things couldn't be rehabilitated, like the frescoes in the assembly room, the Great Hall, they were recreated and protected. The original frescoes were protected, but then recreated on top of them. So it's really beautiful. You know, it's we can't wait to welcome people back in person.
After all those iterations that building went through, what was the process for convincing the city to turn it into a museum?
Well, you know, we take that legacy pretty seriously, that it's been an educational institution. I think that there is a through line there in terms of public education. Museums do education in a different way, right? We are informal, even optional, to learn in a museum. But it's not a departure from the mission of the building. And so, you know, it has been a place where Washingtonians have learned for over 150 years, and we're just the next iteration of that mission.
Going to take a break very shortly, but you can call us at 800-433-8850. We've got a tweet from Marshall who said, "With all of the technology now available in teaching and education, will our experience of museums be different after the pandemic?" Beth Zeebarth, we got about a minute to answer that.
Yes, it will be.
In a word.
There will be new technologies, especially to make sure that people feel comfortable with tactile experiences or touch experiences in museums. But there's lots of encouraging new ways to, innovative ways to provide access to people with disabilities, too.
And so that's going to be going on long after this pandemic is over. 800-433-8850. If you have called, stay on the line. Have you heard about DC's newest museum, the Museum of the Word? Have you virtually visited a museum or gallery? Would you feel comfortable going to a museum in person right now? 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Nand. Welcome back. We've been talking about how museums in this region have been faring during the pandemic. We're talking with Beth Zeebarth, director of the Smithsonian's Office of Accessibility. Rebecca Roberts is curator of programming at Planet Word. And Melanie Adams is director of Smithsonian Anacostia Community Museum. Taking your calls at 800-433-8850. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. And I guess Melanie Adams and Rebecca Roberts, I'll put the same question to you that Beth Zeebarth just answered, and that is, will the programs that you're offering virtually online continue after the pandemic? Are we likely to see a permanent change in how museums operate? Melanie Adams?
Sure. I agree with Beth. We're definitely going to see a hybrid model of both online opportunities as well as in person. And the really nice thing about online is the access. When I'm talking about access, I'm talking geographical. So for our online programs, we're getting people from all over the world tuning in. So it would be a shame for us, once we're able to open back up, to go back to being only in person. So it really does open up opportunities to create more of a hybrid model.
Rebecca Roberts.
I completely agree. And, you know, we've had to experiment with what virtual programming does well, especially in an immersive museum. A sort of less satisfying version of the in-person experience isn't what virtual programming is good for. We don't want a sort of JV version of what you'd get in the museum. But what virtual programming does really well is it allows us to book speakers from all over the world simultaneously. I mean, we recently had a conversation about the power of hip-hop, where we had guests in Mexico City and Milwaukee and Iraq, and audience members from all over the world. And there's a certain intimacy of interaction on Zoom, we're finding, where people are more comfortable jumping in on the chat than they might not be raising their hand in an auditorium or going up to a microphone in the aisle of an auditorium. And so we have been able to expand what we can bring and learn from our audience in a two-way street. So no question, we will absolutely keep up virtual programming after we're able to welcome people in person to the museum. It's just making us a more robust curriculum with a stronger museum experience.
Here now is Hammond in Arlington, Virginia. Hammond, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo, thank you all so much for taking my call. My wife and I miss museums in a big way, like everybody else, I'm sure. But I did want to say that we are taking a number of these Zoom classes with the Smithsonian Associates, and we are thoroughly enjoying this in just a gigantic way. And we're taking this whole series on botanical gardens of the world, and the first program was just fabulous, and we're just totally looking forward to the next. And I hope y'all will, you know, keep some of that going when you open back up. Thank you.
Hammond, thank you very much for your call. Can you offer him that assurance, Beth Zebarth?
I think that the Smithsonian Associates have found this to be a very, an excellent way for them to make their programs available across the country, as Melanie and our other guest have remarked on. And so I think that Smithsonian Associates, like everyone else, will probably be considering a hybrid. I've taken some of those Smithsonian Associates courses myself, and I'm enjoying them too. I'm next going to be doing neighborhood walks through Dublin and several other cities. So I think that'll be fun.
Thank you very much for your call, Hammond. You too can call us if you have a question or comment about museums at 800-433-8850. Here's Judith in McLean, Virginia. Judith, your turn.
Thank you, Kojo. I'm privileged to serve on the board of a tiny museum that was built by the descendants of slaves in the neighborhood where I and many of the descendants still live. One of the things that we have tried to do is get with the rest of the world, and we have Zoom meetings and our board of directors, and we have a video screen where we tell the history of the church museum. This church has a huge interest because so many of the museums are very powerful, these people you're interviewing. But what has been somewhat discouraging to us is we have not found an association of museums from these ancient slave churches to network with. And I'd like to know if any of the panel can familiarize us with other options for networking in terms of what we seek to do on racial reconciliation and history and justice.
Melody Adams, apparently this is a museum that was created by people who were enslaved. You might be able to give Judith some insight.
And Judith, can you just remind me which state are you located in?
Yes, I'm in McLean, Virginia.
Okay, you're in Virginia. So what I would say is there are actually a lot of resources, because a lot of museums are doing this work now around enslaved communities. So I would look first at the Association of African American Museums. That's one great resource. The second one would be the American Alliance of Museums. So you have a AAAM and then an AAM. And then you could also look at AASLH, which is the American Association of State and Local Historical Societies. And then finally, Virginia has a wonderful museum association. So the Virginia Museum Association would be another one, and you would find places in there that are doing very similar work, like Monticello, Mount Pelier, a lot of other sites that are struggling with how to include enslaved narratives in their work.
Judith, thank you very much for your call, and good luck to you. You too can call us at 800-433-8850. Do you think virtual museum tours should continue after the pandemic? Why or why not? 800-433-8850. Rebecca Roberts, you have an event coming up next week called Diversities, Languages, and Innovation. What can you tell us about this event?
Diversities is a series that we have been producing in collaboration with Shared Studios. Shared Studios in the before times had this whole network of physical portals around the world. Most of them are shipping containers, where you walk into the container and you're connected full screen, full body size with somebody in another part of the world. And it facilitates these intimate, interesting conversations globally. When we went to virtual, we were able to connect more than one place at a time. So this Diversities series explores the power of language to affect change. And so we talked about the language of music in activism. We've talked about the language of health messaging and how you target different messages to different populations and how you combat disinformation in health messaging. The one coming up next week on March 17th at 11 is about the language of innovation. And again, guests all over the world who not only have interesting things going on in their locality, but really interesting things to add to each other, because when you gather people who have similar but different perspectives on the same topic, it becomes broader than the sum of its parts. And I think that's something that all of us in cultural institutions are discovering with this kind of virtual programming, that you know, more than a panel on a stage in an auditorium, this ability to have speakers of various perspectives plus the audience perspective gathered in real time online is really creating something new. And the audience is becoming more sophisticated, more adept at the technology, more willing to jump in. So as we've been doing these programs, Diversities and others, I've just been so impressed with the people who are attending them and what they're bringing to the event and how it's really making it even more successful.
You said Diversities and others. Tell us a little bit about some of the others.
Oh, we've been having so much fun with our virtual programming. We've explored how to build a crossword puzzle and how the very weird world of competitive crossword puzzles with Adrian Raffel. We've explored what makes the lyrics of a good love song. We broke down, you know, for Valentine's Day, of course, some of our favorite love songs with Professor Adam Bradley at UCLA, to talk about some of the songwriting techniques that different lyricists use. We had a moment, actually, this was really important to me. We had planned a program on January 7th about poetry with Naomi Shihab Nye and James Cruz. And I moderate these programs, and I sort of woke up that morning and thought, who is going to want to talk about poetry today? January 6th was traumatic. It was all we were talking about. We were all so undone. And I worried that we were being kind of irrelevant. And I so underestimated the people who wanted to find solace and wisdom in poetry, that there was something comforting and important and a long-range vision of how the world goes in poetry. And it's not a place I have sought solace before, but I underestimated the number of people who wanted to do that. And it was one of our best attended, most successful programs. And it just reminded me again why a word museum is important, because there are people all over who understand the power and beauty of words and look to that power and beauty in times of trauma. And so we've had totally fun programs and also some very important programs.
I could have certainly used some poetry on the morning of January 7th, so kudos to you. Kudos to you for doing that. Here is Penny in Montgomery Village. Penny, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo, and hi, Beth. This is Penny Reeder. I have a question about the Panda Cam. Is there a way you guys could add some audio description to the Panda Cam? I could see how you wouldn't be able to do it 24 hours a day. But when the new panda was born, I really wanted to know what he looked like, and there's no description at all. Is there a way to do that?
That's Beth a great Seymour. Hello, yes. Penny. yes, it's good to hear you, and I will talk with my colleagues at the zoo. It's a good point. We need to describe the cute pandas. So I'll work on that.
And speaking of that, Beth, the Smithsonian Museums, the Natural History, Air and Space, and the zoo are so important to parents, not only tourists, but locals. Any advice for parents who are missing those great experiences with kids and are desperate for rainy day weekend plans?
Yeah, sure. Well, we run a program out of our office called Morning at the Museum, which is a free sensory-friendly program for families of children, teens, and young adults with disabilities, including intellectual disabilities, autism, sensory processing disorders, and other cognitive disabilities. So I'll talk a little bit about that, but some of the things that we are doing relate to the family programs that are going on in the different museums. So, you know, prior to the pandemic, families who participated in Morning at the Museum came to the museums before public hours and had the opportunity to explore and participate in activities without some of the environmental concerns that they had. But now we talked with families as the pandemic closed in on us, and we surveyed our 2,000 member list of families to see what they would like to have available to them. They were reporting that they were already experiencing Zoom fatigue with online school, but they would appreciate a weekly list of online resources or activities that they might add to their days. And then recently we started advertising museum family programs to our list, where we worked with educators to tweak their activities to work well for kids with disabilities. And one program that was recently held was at the Smithsonian American Art Museum and the National Museum of Asian Art. They worked on this together, where they did a wearable art program, which was quite popular. You just use things found in the house to create your own wearable art, and it was very popular.
We got an email from Jenna from the Smithsonian, who said, the Smithsonian Associates each live stream programs on Zoom relies on two to three volunteers to manage the Q&A box, chat, and screen sharing introductory slides. It has been an exciting way to welcome remote volunteers from all over the U.S. Not only do we have program attendees from around the world, we have volunteers from Maine to Memphis and from New Jersey to Texas. It's been a wonderful silver lining, and I'm guessing, Beth Seybarth, a silver lining that you hope to continue after this pandemic is over.
Absolutely. I think that we have, as you've heard from all of the panelists and the people calling in, that online programming is here to stay, that this is a great way for us to expand our offerings to an ever wider audience.
Here now is Claudia, who identifies as a fourth grader at Washington Union Public Charter School. Claudia, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello. My name is Claudia Hyman, and I go to, and I live in D.C., and my school is Washington Union PCS. And we used to have field trips to museums, and it was so much fun. And now I can only do it virtually. So sometimes with my friends, I go to the virtual museum.
And do you enjoy it, Claudia?
Yes, it is so much fun looking at the architecture and the space, planets, and I just love museums and those kinds of things.
Well, maybe our guests can tell you what their plans are for reopening their museums. I will start with you, Beth Thebarth. What's the plan for reopening the Smithsonian?
Well, Claudia, I appreciate your interest in museums, and I hope that someday you'll be a curator or somebody who works in one of our museums. But we don't know for sure when we will be opening, but we'll be sometime this spring. We'll open in phases, as we did last summer, making decisions about reopening, keeping in mind health and well-being of our visitors, staff, and volunteers. And we are really looking forward to having the public back in the museums for in-person visits as well as online.
Is that the plan you will follow, Melanie Adams?
That is the plan. But as I mentioned with Men of Change, how we have that exhibit outside, we'll actually be opening an exhibit on April 17th outside called Food for the People, Eating and Activism in Greater Washington. So that will be located outside on our plaza.
And how about you, Rebecca Roberts?
I want to say something about virtual programs, Kojo.
Sure.
So, Claudia, we miss you, too. We miss field trips. We love them in museums. And so virtual field trips is one of the first things we developed when we realized that we wouldn't be able to welcome school groups, because even after the museum reopens, I think that school groups are going to lag behind in terms of their ability to come see us. So our education program manager, Caitlin Miller, developed virtual field trips right out of the gate around some of the stuff you can learn in Planet Word. And they've been so enormously popular. I think teachers are desperate for some content that is delivered by somebody else and is engaging and informal and, in our case, you know, conforms to ELA standards. But you can find virtual field trips from museums all over, and it's, again, an opportunity to learn from an institution that might not be in your backyard, that might not be something you can take a bus to. So we are desperate to have real live field trips back, but in the meantime, virtual field trips has been another real boon, a silver lining from this pandemic experience.
Claudia, thank you very much for your call. You too can call us at 800-433-8850. How have the museums you love been surviving through the pandemic? Do you know? 800-433-8850. Melanie Adams, when you talk about doing Men of Change outdoors, what have you learned about your own profession during this pandemic?
One of the things I learned is that we need to be more flexible and less, I guess, set in our ways, because I think, as always, there's always pushback of, oh, you can't go outdoors, or what is that going to mean? How do you count your audience? Like, all these things and questions. But I think what we've really learned is the community is hungry for us to be in their backyard, and they would love to partner with us. So we've just met some great people working on this exhibit that we wouldn't have met if it were indoors. So I would just encourage museums to take a risk.
Would you say that your community and your audience have actually grown during this pandemic?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Men of Change is being seen, I would estimate, by more people outside than it would be by people who are actually coming to our museum, just by virtue of the space it's in.
Beth Thebarth, last year, the Smithsonian opened up the Native American Veterans Memorial during the pandemic. What was that like, holding a ceremony for a new memorial online, and what advantages did that have, or what disadvantages were there to it?
Yeah, it was such an exciting experience to have the memorial open on the grounds of the National Museum of American Indian, and we certainly had to pivot to doing an online opening ceremony instead of a in-person ceremony, but the advantage is that people from, you know, all parts of Indian country could participate, from Alaska to, the tip of Florida. So I think that that's one advantage. And I believe the museum is hoping to have an in-person ceremony down the road once we get past the pandemic.
Tell us about the Smithsonian Accessibility Innovation Fund. What is it and how does it work?
Sure. Well, while we're teleworking, we continue to plan for new and better ways to engage visitors with disabilities. And my office manages an annual pool of funds to encourage innovative ways to provide accessibility. And one of the projects that I'll highlight establishes a new method, a medium for visual description of museum artwork and objects. So for a visitor who is blind or has low vision, they will be able to use a handheld device or their smartphone to scan a painting, and they will hear different tones for different colors and visual descriptions so that they can better form an understanding of the composition of the artwork in their mind's eye.
Here now is Stanley in Mount Rainier, Maryland. Stanley, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call, Kojo. I wanted to say, first of all, I have thoroughly enjoyed some online programming from different museums and individuals and other outside organizations. I've recently taken a tour of some of the highlights of the African American Museum, which I've not yet had a chance to see. Beyond that, since you are not bound by either time or space, some groups have given virtual tours from multiple museums. For instance, one recently gave a tour of one of the French Impressionists that, based on paintings that are in the National Gallery as well as museums in Baltimore and Richmond. And I think that's wonderful to realize that you have much fewer constraints when you can do these programs online. So my question is, do you think that the museums are open to doing some collaboration and showing special programming that exhibits artwork from the different museums together at one time?
Beth Zeebarth?
Yeah, I think that collaboration has always been high and on our agenda in museums. And I think that the idea of being able to share collections with visitors through an online experience means that we don't have to ship, artwork, loaned artwork or loaned objects. So that's a good advantage.
And thank you very much for your call,
Stanley. Interesting.
We've got about 30 seconds. Go ahead, please.
So, for instance, we collaborated with the Museum of Math in New York to talk about where language and math intersect. So not just collections, but there's some really interesting thematic collaborations out there that virtual programming allows you to take advantage of.
Rebecca Roberts is the curator of programming at Planet Word. Melanie Adams is director of the Smithsonian Anacostia Community Museum. And Beth Zeebarth is director of the Smithsonian's Office of Accessibility. Thank you all for joining us. Today's show on how DC museums have adapted during the pandemic was produced by Richard Cunningham. Coming up tomorrow on the Politics Hour, Congresswoman Jennifer Wexton of Virginia joins us to talk about the massive stimulus plan, which President Joe Biden is expected to sign this week, and her thoughts about the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Then Montgomery County Councilmember Nancy Navarro discusses disparities with the vaccine rollout and what the loosened coronavirus restrictions will mean for Maryland's most populous county. That all starts tomorrow at noon. Until then, thank you for listening and stay safe. I'm Kojo Namdi.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.